chasing that wage up. Inflation, chase it like a hidden taxation. Manipulated interest rates to get the bank ready to create money with the loans that they're giving out daily. That means our money is dead, and we gotta pay back more than 100%. No wonder then why the middle class is going under when the ones above them gotta cover and come to collect. And many have no access to banking, making payments or saving, so more fees are taken. And every day the gatekeepers are trying to stop change. We cannot wait. Welcome to the blockchain.
Good afternoon. Welcome to the Henry Rain Show here on WWPR 1490 AM. Heard every Monday immediately after Talking Markets with Mark and Andrew. Normally, this is your weekly roundup of Bitcoin, cryptocurrency, blockchain news, and more. But in these times of COVID-19, quarantine, and more, we're changing the format again like we did a couple weeks ago. Yep. Seems like there's no days left anymore. It's just one long sitting on your couch nap, and once a week coming to the studio.
Actually, I'm staying busy, so I can't complain.
Well, that's good. And, of course, because we're like Pavlov's dogs around here, we don't do anything until our cue is played and we respond and our ears perk up, whether it's my theme music or Andy's theme music. And that, of course, is the co-host, co-founder of GreenBridgeInvesting.com, Talking Markets with Mark and Andrew, comes on 4:05 here and then followed by the Henry Rain Show at 5:05. And hopefully we have our guest on the line. We haven't gotten any technical glitches here. And this is a very special guest. Met him about almost 10 years ago. At that time, I was about half his age. So now I'm about 60% of his age. So I'm aging faster than he is by the way my math works. Anyway, Joe Newman is a former congressional write-in candidate about 6 years ago or so. And that's just a blink of an eye for someone that was born in 1913 and is 107 years old and is going to share with us a whole lot
can't even imagine
of history. And we are going to try and replay this. I guess this would be a great time for me to play a sponsor's commercial. So why don't I do that, and I will try one more time here to get him on the air. And you're listening to the Henry Rain Show. And we are going to go back to the phone lines right now and see if we can bring Joe Newman on the air. Joe, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay. Should be able to hear a little bit better anyway through the audio board as opposed to that phone line. Well, as I was just telling the people, you are a former congressional write-in candidate. You took on Vern Buchanan about 6 years ago.
When I was 101, that's a long time ago.
Some things are just the blink of an eye, it seems like. But you've done much, much more than that. We're going to get into some of that in a little bit. But as I just told the audience, you're born in 1913, which in these days of coronavirus and COVID-19 fears and all the things that go involved with something that we refer to as a pandemic, you would have been 5 years old when the Spanish flu pandemic hit the United States and the rest of the world. Now, I don't expect you to have a lot of vivid memories of that, but maybe you have some sense of that. And, you know, because everybody says that things are unprecedented. You know, every pundit, every talking head, this is unprecedented. Well, if you got enough perspective, it's not unprecedented.
Well, I can't even imagine back then. I didn't have none of the ventilators or anything like that we have now. So
let's try this again. Joe, are you still there? Yeah, okay, because somebody just tried to dial through the computer again.
Yeah, I'm still here.
Yeah, okay. So what are your memories of that? Do you have any?
You asked me about, when I was 5 years old. I can't, I don't remember much that I can specifically relate to the flu epidemic, except that a kid across the street, I was only five, but he was a little bit younger, died from the, because of the flu. That was the only near incident. That's how I try to remind people, is that at that time, we didn't have television or we didn't have radio, and so the fear of it didn't come from watching it every day and being reminded of it. It would come from our own my parents, my mother, who would want me to keep washing my hands, but that wouldn't be unusual, or boiling water and things. So I can't remember it particularly as an epidemic or being involved in it.
Well, what about just your daily circumstances as a normal life, as you remember it as a young boy? Where did you live, and what were the circumstances of how you lived?
Well, that's the way I can get myself to remember anything, Henry, as I'm trying to picture the neighborhood in my own mind that we lived in at that time in the house, and then try to remember incidents that happened about it. And I can remember that we lived on Prairie Avenue in South Bend, and that at that time it was a little bit at the edge of the town, and so the things that I do remember explicitly are the putting up the signs on the doors for quarantine. In other words, the public health department that they had at that time would go around and quarantine a house that had the flu or any indication of it, and they would have a sign on there and quarantine and indicate flu. And that's what I remember, and doing a little bit of, since I've been asked this question before, is checking and finding out that there were 175 people in South Bend that died, and probably the population was only around 60,000. And that Notre Dame had, and churches were closed, and that Notre Dame had canceled some football games. Other than that, I would be inserting things which I'm not sure of, which I really don't specifically remember.
Do you remember any sense of fear from you? Well, you mentioned that your mom wanted you to wash your hands. And would you call this like a middle class kind of neighborhood that you were in?
No, wait a minute. Do you remember Newt Rockne? you're a Notre Dame fan. Do you remember Newt Rockne? So do you remember Newt Rockne? You say you're from South Bend area, Indiana, Notre Dame.
They're not getting you on the captioning.
Let me ask for Andy, because he was over here. He had to jump in because he's a big football fan. And not only that, Joe is a Notre Dame graduate.
Oh, wow.
So Andy had to ask you about Newt Rockne. Did you have any remembrance of him when you were going to college?
Do I what?
The football coach, Newt Rockne. Was he a larger-than-life character for you at that time?
Oh, yeah. Well, not exactly at five, not till they got a little bit older. And then not that much older. You know, it was only a few years later that the kids in the neighborhood, we would hitchhike out to Notre Dame and watch the team practice. So, sure, you know, Rockne was a big thing in life in all of South Bend. But then my association with Notre Dame started then, and going out and watching the team practice and then sneaking into football games.
So we jumped around a little bit. Just for the sake of the audience, let me go back. So you're five when the 1918 pandemic came by. You remember your mother's concern with washing your hands and the
boiling
health
water.
Department coming by.
Yeah, boiling water. But
yep.
No, that wasn't unusual. My mother was one of those that wanted you to boil the water. And you have to remember, we probably didn't have a water heater. And so the only way we could get hot water would be boiling it. So I do remember my mother doing that.
Now, that would have been before telephones were common, wouldn't it?
That is correct.
What about electricity?
We happen to have electricity in the house we were in, and there are many houses without it.
Okay. And besides the pandemic, what were some of the other concerns that you just have a recollection of growing up that you're, because you would have been just wrapping up World War One. The world was, you had the
Dust Bowl,
the pandemic. No, that's later. We're good.
Okay.
You gotta go one decade at a time.
Okay.
Right.
So, well, you had the smallpox epidemic in the 20s.
Well, Joe, what was some of the other landmarks of your youth that you remember as before you got to like high school age and college age?
Well, the caption just went off. I didn't hear it. You asked, about in the World War One. I had an older brother who was 11 years older than I, and he had lied about his age and enlisted early, and so had somebody, relative in the war. And I do remember, of course, the armistice and the parades. And when I'm reminded about the war, what I remember specifically are the flags that were hung in the window, the stars, the gold stars, indicating some having one or two members of the family in the Army.
And did you have one of those in your window then?
I'm sorry?
Then you had one of those in your window at your home?
Well, we had one because my brother was in the, he wasn't overseas. He spent his time in Marfa, Texas. Yeah, but then we had one.
Well, that was probably a good thing.
So it's sort of an interesting story how your family came to be in South Bend, because actually it starts back in the 19th century. When your parents immigrated from Russia, but they were in Siberia, so there was a lot of anti-Semitism in Russia, correct, at that time? I mean, all through the 16, 17, 1800s, but your parents suffered under that.
Well, anyway, my parents were activists, and in fact, they met in Siberia, in Yakutsk is the name of the village, and it was what they would now call a gulag. And they were activists, each individually were activists, and would go out handing out leaflets opposing the Tsar. And so they were sent to Siberia for that reason. And my father, they were released because, they've served a certain period of time. My father was sent to Vladivostok. That was when Russian and Japanese were at war. And the story as we get it is just as he got to Vladivostok, peace was declared, and so they let him go back. He went back to his own community and then came to this country.
Now, did they ever talk about why they were activists? Was it because of oppression of Jewish people, or they were just against the monarchy, or what was the reason?
Well, they were against the Tsar. That was the reason. I suppose right now they would be labeled as socialists because they were for the replacement or the overthrow of the Tsar. And
which Tsar was that?
We're part of the we're part of that movement that wanted to get rid of the Tsar and replace him with a more democratic form of government. When I tell people that, I like to remind them it's not because they Das Kapital, it's because they would have heard about Jefferson and Lincoln and Franklin and all the people in America who were creating the kind of government we have here.
Now, I understand that your parents went to Siberia because they were sent, and that was retribution for them. But as I was researching this, it was almost in a strange way a mirror image of the United States with the westward push, that there were actually homestead-like acts that the Russian government had, and there were Jewish families that were actually able to go out to the east instead of go west, young man. It was go east, young man. And communities were set up, and they because they were so far from the central government, they had freedom of religion, periodic oppression, but compared to the more European part of Russia. And so the Jewish communities thrived for some bit out there. Do you ever think, I guess they don't have any fond memories of that, but is there something now looking back that maybe we're a lot alike? There was talking about the Russian people, the American people, and we're just divided by propaganda and ideas.
Well, of course we're divided by propaganda and all that. If you talk about, and of course there was anti-Semitism. My parents broke away from religion when they were young. You have to remember that when they were involved in this kind of activity, my father was probably just about 20 or 19. My mother was only 18. And they were just like the millennials now, who were active in the change, in trying to seek change. Now, my parents would not, the anti-Semitism was part, the fact that it was supported by the Tsar was part of the reason for the desire for change. My parents, felt that the rabbinic organization, always happens, would have been influenced and by the Tsar and the government, and therefore they would have been. That's one of the reasons why they broke from religion, because they felt that the rabbinic hierarchy did not join in the protest of anti-Semitism and all that, and the position of them was that they would be able, that they, the hierarchy would be able to handle it, and that's been going on since then.
Now, did they ever speak about the ship coming to America? Because it couldn't have been a quick trip, all the way across the Pacific. Did they ever talk about the sea passage to the U.S. and how did they wind up in the middle of the country in South Bend?
Oh, well, all right. They had family in Chicago. My mother had family in Chicago. My father had no family here. My mother had family in Chicago. They went to Chicago and they were barely eking out a living. My father made wigs. And my mother would hawk newspapers. She'd go out and buy 10 or 15 newspapers and go out and sell them for a penny more than she had paid for them. This is back now in 1915, when automobiles were just beginning to come in, and Studebaker started making automobiles. Studebaker was famous for the covered wagon that they made, and so they were converting it to making automobiles and were seeking help, and that became known. And so my father just picked up the family and took us to South Bend, and he went to work for Studebaker's.
And then, so by the time they come to America, they're sharing the same story as a lot of immigrants and trying to make their way and pull themselves up through the hard work. Did they speak English?
They both took took courses in learning English. And as far as we're concerned, they did fairly well with it.
So then they come to South Bend. I know in the past you've told me that they have like a little general grocery store. Did their social activism, did that come down to the children?
Yes, it did. It still is in existence in organization. It's called the Workman's Circle, which was a rather liberal or left or socialist thinking organization. I must probably call more like a brotherhood. They had have, you know, they have cemeteries, and they try to start a health insurance program. But I remember my parents were part of it in South Bend, and so as kids we were involved in that kind of a movement from almost the time we could understand. It was interesting to me. Now, you know, we didn't have the grocery store then. We didn't have it till later, and my mother just converted a house, took the living room of our house, and began to put shelves in it and started to have a little grocery store in the neighborhood. And that was maybe, you know, five or six. Yeah, we were there. I was probably around 9 or 10 at that time. And that's why we started the grocery store. Studebakers would be laying people off. You didn't have that much, that steady of an employment that you could depend upon it. And that's how we got into the grocery store. But as far as the being involved in social thinking, being part of that organization is where we learned it. Interesting thing is that most of the people that almost everybody I knew in it was a professional. They either had a grocery store or a dry goods store. They weren't people, they weren't homeless people who were looking for a change in government for a handout. They had certain beliefs, societal beliefs, and that's what I find interesting. And that continued most of them that I knew.
Well, it sounds like that your mom was the real entrepreneur in the family, and I guess would be an example that social justice and entrepreneurship don't have to be mutually exclusive then.
That's right. Well,
so let me get back to you, though, Joe, because, I mean, we could talk here forever, and I don't want to keep you forever.
I could listen forever. This is great.
Yeah. Andy will be over to the apartment later tonight. But let's go to you, because, I mean, this is really actually an incredible American story that this husband and wife come from a gulag in Russia. They bring their family, and then you're born here, but they raise a family in the U.S., and you go on to graduate from Notre Dame. What about your path? How did you go through? What was high school like in South Bend back then? How did you wind up in Notre Dame, other than being close?
Well, I wound up in Notre Dame because that was the only thing we could afford. You know, Notre Dame is in South Bend. And in my own individual case at Notre Dame, it's I probably went there almost. Almost free. My mother had the grocery store, and we didn't have any cash buildup. It was fall of 1932, I think, and we didn't have any money to send me to. No, it was 33. Didn't have any money to send me to school, and one of the customers. Gave her the money, said, we're going to be buying groceries here. We'll give you enough money for him to enter Notre Dame. And I think at that time it was $125. And so he paid in advance, our doctor, who happened to be the customer.
For a year or for 4 years?
Paid his for his groceries in advance. And so the next day I went out in the name and registered, and then told them that if I was going to continue school, I would need help from them. And they gave me a job.
So before you go farther, so $125 to go into Notre Dame. Now, did that cover the year or longer?
That covered the first trimester. My parents had one of these at that time. Some insurance companies would go out, and I think for 25 cents a week or something, they would sell an insurance policy. And we had a policy that was worth $125. And so we gave Notre Dame that policy, which is worth $125, and $125 in cash. And that's all I paid for my university education.
So
the rest of it, they gave me jobs.
Did the other siblings go to college or just you?
I'm sorry?
Did your other siblings go to college?
Yes, my brother went, yes. My brother went to Notre Dame also, and for the same reason. We couldn't afford to go anywhere else.
Now, when you entered college, what was your dream? What did you see yourself doing? What did you dream for your future life? I mean, it's at the height of the Depression. You probably just wanted to eat.
I majored in accounting. And Henry, if you want me to pat myself on the back, I got a BCS in accounting and was rated cum laude.
All right.
Oh, wow.
Well, that's what we like to hear.
Mm-hmm.
So,
so it was a different time back then, and you see today.
And let me just point out, so that you got that degree at the height of the Depression. So it wasn't like it was just going to be easy street coming out of college.
That is right.
Okay, Andy had something.
Yeah, you know, you see today, and you got a lot of people, they think things are owed them. You know, socialism was kind of brought up a different name and stuff like that. And everything's owed. And you kind of come from that era where you didn't get anything from anybody unless you made it. How do you kind of look at, you know, you grew up in the, you know, obviously you grew up in the one of the roughest times in America during the Great Depression. And that, what do you think of the kids today and how they have things? Is it, you know, I just kind of looking at that perspective. What's your feelings on that? Or how do you think the kids today compared to them? Are they spoiled or what?
Can't generalize. You can't sit here and be critical or try to describe everybody who goes to school. A lot of kids, you know, there are many who are going. I'm going to back away from that. I don't think it's true. I think the great majority of kids do want to do work. They do want to fulfill their profession, whatever it is they're taking. And I think sometimes we, because of a minority, we label the great many as doing that. You have to remember that life is different. When we came out with the Depression, you knew damn well it was going to be a lot of good fortune would be required. And it did happen to me. Social Security was starting. Actually, I wanted to go on and become a lawyer, and I couldn't afford that. And I was about to get married. And so I was fortunate that Social Security had, that bill had been passed, and they were developing the bureaucracy for running the program, and I and probably a few thousand others was invited to become part of that, and I was fortunate to be picked from that group that was hired to be trained to go out in the field to help administer and sell Social Security and found it quite interesting. So to get back to the kids, but I think most of them, you know, given a good opportunity, are are interested in creating a better society, and that's why you have an active millennial group.
By the way, if you just tuned in, we're speaking with Joe Newman, 107 years old. He's looking back at a lot of things that are relevant to everybody right now. We're just talking now about 1937 when he helped go out and get people signed up for Social Security, but he just spent his college years in the height of the Great Depression. And, you know, taking us full circle, you know, we started this conversation about the pandemic of 1918 and what we're facing now, but really compared to our own pandemic now, what's coming next may be more to fear than the pandemic itself, that we might be experiencing a Great Depression of our own very soon here. We've got, what, close to 20% unemployment now, and the GDP, the gross domestic product of the U.S., is falling by 30% in a quarter. Looking back from, you know, you were in a spot at Notre Dame where you had some stability. You had to work for it, but with stability. But you must have seen people suffering out in the world as you were out there in the Great Depression.
Well, that, of course, that was before I went to Notre Dame. Things were a little bit better. You know, we'd have the WPA, and we had other things that had been put in into effect. The time after I graduated high school, and at that, you know, those years, jobs were almost impossible to find. In fact, I tell the story, and it's not a story. There was a young man who had become my brother-in-law, that we found that there was a filling station where the owner was getting out of the business, was retiring. And then we thought, well, we would get together, because we couldn't afford it individually. So we would get together and take over that filling station so that we, because we couldn't find a job otherwise. And we were supposed to meet with the people regarding it the next day or a couple of days later. And I came to find out that my brother-in-law had made arrangements with somebody else then to get the money to get it for himself. So the point I'm trying to make is the Depression made people. You know, my brother-in-law was a good person, but in order to find a job, you would almost do anything. I remember, Henry, that, you know, we, part of my own experiences, there was, we went with a, there was an organization that would, you could, I as an individual, this I'm screaming this up, I as an individual could buy groceries, and then I would go out into the countryside and try to sell them to farmers, and then you'd pick up an order for the next week, and you get it, and you try to add an order and make a little commission. And Jewel Tea Company, you know, and they came up with this idea, and it was putting people to work. And so the only thing wrong is anybody could do it, so that you would almost be parking in the same parking lot that the somebody else in front of you was going to that same farmhouse to sell. But and you know that we went around selling sharpeners for razor blades, because people couldn't afford to buy razor blades, or a lot of people couldn't, and so you would try to sell them a sharpener. You did anything. And you know, I remember getting a job working at a filling station finally. And I had to work from midnight till 8 o'clock, 7 days a week, and I got $8 a week. So,
what was gas back then?
You depend upon good fortune. But you mentioned, I'm sorry to keep going, but then, the pandemic is when the pandemic is over, we will still have societal problems. We've got problems to solve in this country and in every country. And there, for people to have jobs, to have income, to provide for their future, you know, we have this buildup of school loans, and so the epidemic came along and just pushed every one of our other problems aside, and said this is the major problem of the day, which it is. But I don't think, you know, I think we're going to be making a mistake if we feel that once this virus scare is over, that things will be settled down and everybody will be comfortable. That won't be true.
Joe, you know, I remember my parents would be the World War II generation, and every one of my friends growing up, their dad did something in the war. You know, he was in the military, most likely, but it was this shared consciousness, this shared memory that cut across all of society. They all had participated in it. Are we going to wind up with a generation that has a shared common view of the world from all this? Because in the last few decades, I mean, it just cuts across. Everybody is involved in this situation that we're living right now.
Well, that's what we're all talking about, and that's possibly one of the hopes that this will teach us of our needs and dependence upon each other. You know, you and I are talking over the phone, so we don't have to worry. But if we're sitting in the same room, do I worry about you carrying something that's going to harm me? And do you have to be concerned about me carrying a germ that affects you? And we are dependent upon each other. We can hope that we learn from this experience our need for a well-functioning society that is concerned about the members of that society. Now, whether we'll end up that or we'll end up with individuals who say, I want this over so I can go back out to my golf game or whatever it is, then once again, it will be a possible lesson not learned.
Right. We've been speaking with Joe Newman. I don't want to keep you too long. Joe, do you want to talk any more or do you have to go?
Well, it's about time. I'm an old man.
All right. Well,
can I ask one question? What was, you know, you've come across many decades, and I'm amazed. I used to do antiques in that, and I always always intrigued with people that had old stories and stuff like that. And that, what was one of the most interesting inventions, or the invention that you thought really changed the world the most throughout your life?
Well, I'm not so sure that it has changed the world that much. It has a great deal. The thing, that amazes me the most, and you have to remember, I can remember when radio came in, I can remember when television started, and then computers. What amazes me is the cell phone, that you can have whatever number, three or four people in a single room, each making phone calls to a different person, and that phone call, as I understand it, waves go up to a certain spot, and then they're sent out to different numbers. Now, how in the hell that can happen, I don't know. But to me, well, if you ask me what I think is the most amazing, that's probably it.
Well, I thought you were going to tell us that it was that four people could be sitting in the room talking to other people and never look at each other for the whole time.
That's right. The strange thing is that voice is going somehow. And so makes me think that, gee, if I live long enough, maybe the waves of George Washington making his farewell address are still out there in the air someplace.
Well, I think that's actually at least the light images of him doing it are somewhere out there.
Yeah.
I don't know if the audio, you're going to be able to pick up that audio, but get out there far enough, you can probably see that light coming. Joe, thank you so much. I'm going to, not right after the show, but I'll be in touch later so that I can send you a copy of the show. And, again, I appreciate it, and have a great evening, and we'll talk again, I hope.
Yeah, well, I hope it was as interesting to you as it was to me.
Absolutely.
All right. Thank you, Joe.
Thank you, Henry.
Bye.
Oh, that's a great interview. That was probably one of the better ones. You know, you get that peer into history. You're hearing about no TV, no radio. Imagine being in quarantine with no TV or no radio. You know, you can go home and you're flipping on Netflix and you can go on a binge watching stuff and order from Amazon and the food comes to your, you know, food comes dropped off at your door. Back then they didn't have none of that. I mean, that just amazing, just the difference in times. It's just kind of it's amazing to kind of peer
into
that.
Some of that I had heard before, but I hadn't heard the story about his mom being a corner newspaper person selling those newspapers. And the other thing about that, because that, okay, so that's going to be around 1905. That's like the days of William Randolph Hearst and Pulitzer and stuff. And I guess they wouldn't have messed with a grown woman doing that, but the Chicago gangs grew out of the newspaper boys because they learned that controlling turf, and you didn't let, and then to control your corner, you had to, you know, bond with some other guys that, and you
got this corner, I got this corner, we kind of keep an eye on each other.
Yeah, but I guess luckily for it is, or maybe his mom smacked him around. I mean, she had to be pretty tough coming out of a gulag in Russia.
Yeah. You don't make it out of there. Or, you know, Siberia gulags. Wow. I mean, that's just an amazing story. But you get that peer into history. It's just makes you really.
Obviously, it wasn't for his parents. But when I was trying to find background on all this, and of course, you know, there were things called pogroms, which were, you know, people think about the Nazis and what they did to the Jews. Well, it wasn't quite that bad. But it was bad.
Yeah.
I mean, it would go through waves, you know, 20, 30 years would go by, and then they'd be mad at them. And so they found, you know, just like the original colonists that came here, they were prisoners, you know. They were the ethnic groups that weren't desirable.
Not
they
desirable,
were the religious
yeah.
groups that weren't desirable. And actually, the Russian Tsar and the government were like, well, once they built the Trans-Siberia pipeline, that was a different century, railroad, they're like, well, we need some people out there.
Yeah.
And, you know, they had all these oppressed people. They're like, we'll go.
Yeah, why not?
We can be in the snow over here. We can be in the snow over there. So, anyway, well, that was I'm glad you were here to share that.
Yeah, it was a great interview.
No. We may be back to our regular format here,
who knows these days. It's interesting. You hear that, you know, like you said, they come from such a time that, where you had so little, and today we're so spoiled. You can imagine going through an epidemic back then. I mean, there was no there was no fight over hydrochloroquine and Z-Pax. I mean, it was like you were lucky to get anything.
Do you this is like tangential relation, because we're all worried about a vaccine now.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was the first vaccine, but do you know when of course smallpox was a scourge of the human race?
Mm-hmm.
Do you know when the first recorded use of a vaccine was?
Mm-hmm.
1500s in China.
Oh, really?
For smallpox.
Oh, okay.
And George Washington, in the Revolutionary War here in the U.S., had to convince his army to take the smallpox vaccine because it was ravaging the army. And, there are a lot of things that changed the history of the U.S., but a smallpox vaccine might have been one of those things that would have, been the U.S. or no U.S. We could be saying hail to the queen right now.
No, you know, the Chinese also invented the banknote. That was back then. Marco Polo brought it back from there. So, but yeah, it's that was a great interview. Loved it. Thank you, Joe. No, you. I hope you're tuning in. And I'd like to have him back. I mean, there's a lot of questions I had. I couldn't get a word in, you know?
Well, like I said, we'll just drop in with him over there.
Absolutely.
He's got a lovely partner, Anita. I haven't met her, but I've seen pictures of her on Facebook. He was robbing the cradle a little bit, though, on that one.
That's all right.
Yeah, she just turned 100.
They've been together
a long time. He'll be listening to this now when I actually get him the recording. But I got to wonder, you know, as when you get into those senior situations, the odds, the demographic odds are changing. There's a lot fewer men and a lot more women. So I wonder if...
So you're saying you may get lucky in about 20 years.
Well, no, I wasn't thinking that. I was thinking, like, I wonder if Anita has to... you know, lay the smack down on a few women around that place. You stay away from my man.
Yeah, that's it.
All right. Well, we want to thank you for joining us today, and we'll be back next week with another Henry Ranch Show.
Old pirates, yes, they rabbi, sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit, but my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We forward in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever